Are we building tech that lasts or just chasing the next shiny thing? Welcome back to The Intersection, where power, policy, and progress converge. Today, we're sitting down with Sherelle Dorsey, founder, journalist, and sharp voice on the future of tech, sustainability, and equity, to unpack what's real and what's just hype. After, we'll hear from Mitch Bierman on how Miami is positioning itself as the hub for sustainable growth. Let's get into it. So Sherelle, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you. I know you're a busy lady, so this means a lot to even have you here today. But you have been have built a career spotlighting culture, innovation, and really being that intersection. What drew you to this career in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, just thank you so much for having me. It really is an honor to be here. I have always been fascinated by how technology is this equalizer, right? I think so much about growing up in a city like Seattle, where so much of the example was Microsoft and Bill Gates, right? And like innovation looked a very certain way. It was having a personal home computer was like a big deal. I'm considered a geriatric millennial. And so that was like back in the day when the internet, you had to dial into the internet to get online. Right. And and so I was very privileged in, you know, being able to be on the front lines of seeing this shift of technology really opening doors. I learned how to code in high school. I worked at Microsoft in high school. And so for the summers, I would be on campus. They had these futuristic prototype homes. This was like AI before AI became a thing. And it was always sort of in the back of my mind that technology can do just so much. And when we think innovation, it's not limited, right? If you have the desire, the curiosity to learn something and to create it, like you can essentially take the technical tools and create whatever it is that you want. And then of course, like fast forward, you know, 20 something years, and we have entire groups and swaths of people who've been able to create incredible businesses online, right? In a variety of different ways. I think almost every day I'm seeing people create and craft businesses in just ways that I myself would have never even thought of. And I think it's so cool and so fascinating. You know, the tools, the platforms that have been, that have elevated people in so many ways, right? It doesn't matter, like, if you didn't grow up in Seattle next to a Microsoft, right? You can be anywhere in the world, you know, creating or using the tools to develop something that changes entire communities. And so I just always, and even just to this day, continue to stay fascinated and curious about how innovation continues to evolve the more access people have, you know, to the tools that enable them to take things to the next level.
Absolutely. So let's talk about that word access, right? Because your experience of technology and innovation in Seattle is much different than mine in Miami Gardens, right? Yeah. Probably stark contrast. But from your experience, what, how has technology allowed certain communities to have more access, say, than others? And how do, in your work, do you work to make it more of an equitable playing field?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm grateful that I had a grandfather who was a technophile and who didn't have a high school education, but had gone to like a certification program back in the day, the like Detroit Electronic and Television Trade School program. And from that, Boeing had called up his school and said, hey, we need some workers for our aircrafts to work on our assembly line. And so he was like, we'll take everybody you got that just graduated out of this 1 year program. So my grandfather hopped on a Greyhound bus in like the 1950s in Detroit, downtown Detroit, and went downtown Seattle and started working at Boeing for $2.38 an hour. And that's how he built his life up, you know, stayed at the YMCA and ate French fries. Like that was how his origin story started in the technology space. And so when my cousins and I were growing up, he and personal computers became a thing, he bought us each a computer. And I remember getting on this thing, installing, you know, the Microsoft suite. I want to say it was like Microsoft Publisher and some other things. And I'm like making business cards, websites, like I'm figuring this whole thing out, right? And I always go back to that moment because I think about how technology created an opportunity for my grandfather who was not formally educated, right? Just curious and willing to try something in order to get a job to take care of his family, right?
Right.
I think about all of the opportunities that I was part of a program called the Technology Access Foundation in Seattle, which for the last 25 plus years has been working with communities of color, students of color, parents of color, and teaching STEM skills. It started off as an after-school program, and it was teaching us from the inner city just how to code and basic, you know, typing and writing skills. So I even just think about the fact that it opened doors for us. I have friends that I graduated from that program with who've been engineers at Netflix, right? Or Expedia, or all of these like major tech companies. And on even a smaller scale as well, when we think about the ability to market your business, maybe it's a barbershop. Like I grew up working in my aunt's hair salon. So when I first think about a startup, I think about, you know, the dance school and the hair salon and the barbershop, because though that's what was in my communities where we saw entrepreneurs, right? And so just being able to establish an online presence, right? Being able to connect with other business owners, connect to opportunities and within the city, right? To be able to leverage resources. That honestly, I feel like the access point has also opened the potential for learning, right? I think about, and that's even just across generations, right? It's no more about like formally going into a physical place or a physical program. I have friends whose husbands or boyfriends went from, you know, working for FedEx or something like that and learned cloud computing or took an IBM like free certification program in data analytics, right? And then they were able to get hired, you know, into a formal, you know, tech job in some capacity. So I think I'm answering your original question, but there's just so many examples about, you know, access and opportunity. Right. And that's through education, that's through, you know, building a business, you know, that's through just even being able to be connected to city services, right?
Right.
Those things fundamentally have helped transform and enhance people's quality of life.
No, absolutely. And I think I'm happy that you expanded so much because you showed where access is easily accessible, because sometimes we think access and we think that there needs to be some grand movement or gesture, but these small moments of opportunity, whether it's the after school program or it's, you know, starting a job that maybe on one side of the face, it looks like one thing, but then you realize like, oh, I'm learning how to code, or there's this technology component that I never thought was tied to this job in the first place. So I'm glad that you went where you went, because I think it showed us and it lets our viewer know that we might be doing it in ways right now that you don't realize it, right? So I think that's important as well. Now, something else that I know you're really passionate about is our environment and climate control and all those other great things, right? Sometimes when we hear about technology and innovation and the data centers and the energy that's needed to produce this technology and this innovation, it does not necessarily coincide with being environmental friendly, right? So how do you still champion both sides? And how do we really be sustainable and innovative at the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, this is definitely the question, you know, of this era, right? How do we advance? How do we create more opportunity? How do we leverage all of these tools that we've been building to make our lives easier, to make work easier, right? And take advantage, you know, everyone get an opportunity to take advantage of the tools, and not just AI, right? Data centers have long existed, right? Every time we have uploaded a photo to Facebook. Every time we, you know, we are clicking through a website or checking email. I'm so sorry, I was hearing some clicks.
Okay. Good.
So every time we, you know, we upload a photo to Facebook, we're checking email, we're playing a game on our phones, we're downloading an app. All mm-hmm. of these things have taken data center power, right? We don't have an online world without data centers. Now, obviously, the expansion of artificial intelligence has required that we do have more power, right? And it's been highly controversial in terms of the way that these centers have been built. So, you know, so data centers have long existed. We've long been, you know, a culture that relies heavily on being interconnected through data or through the opportunity that data centers have provided. And so the issue around power efficiencies have been a long-standing challenge. I'm probably one of those folks in tech who, and in this space, as an environmentalist, who does believe that both artificial intelligence and solving for the climate crisis have to be intertwined. Mm-hmm. And usually there are folks who are totally against this, right? The challenge is that we already know that major tech companies are continuously going to expand and innovate, right? There's just tremendous profit, tremendous opportunity. And even if we look at the great sides of AI, when we think about medical diagnostics, right? Especially in developing countries where there may not have as many in-person doctors. And so you need some of these tools to help save lives, right? There are some amazing things that these tools can do. There's also an incentive for companies to find the cheapest way in which to power their data centers. So what I'm not condoning is going into neighborhoods and communities and being a pollutant. I think there definitely has to be some regulations around that. What I am excited about is that as the technology gets smarter, as the design of data centers gets smarter, inevitably efficiencies are going to increase. And it's going to require time, right? Remember when the cell phone first came out, right? And how clunky it was. Yeah. And now over time, you have the small thing that fits into your bag, right?
Right.
And so as the technology advances and AI allows that to advance at a very rapid pace, we're seeing more experimentation with single use cooling systems or plant-based cooling systems or, you know, cooling via renewable energies. So I believe that there's going to be better opportunity because it's an incentive, right? Like tech companies in general want to continue to reduce the bottom line, right? Yeah. And so we'll see just better, you know, better overall design, better material design, and also hopefully if they're working with communities and urban planners, finding them placing these data centers in much more or much less harmless, you know, environments as well. So again, I know it's a touchy subject, but I'm really, really excited about the fact that that as data centers expand, that they can get better, faster, and rely on more renewables versus taking existing resources.
No, completely agree. And I think that's why I wanted to ask you this question, because I know you champion both efforts, right? And so it's important for people to see that the two can exist. And even in my work as a land use attorney, we see data centers being established in larger and bigger, right? We need more power. We need more production. AI is the top of everybody's minds, but we have to figure out a way to do it where we're still sustainable and protecting this world that we love so deeply. Something else that you speak on that almost, you know, also low-key convicted me, right? It kind of made me start thinking about myself was fast fashion and what it does to our environment. It's something that all the girls, right? We see all the little the ads on Instagram, and it's quick to get this outfit and that outfit. but what is it doing and how is it affecting us? Can you share a little bit about just your experience? And I know you love fashion yourself. I follow you on Instagram, right? Yeah. You look good. So let's start there. But how do you do that in a sustainable way and still, you know, feel and look good?
It's a big challenge, right? I think we've all seen the images of piles and piles of textiles being washed ashore, particularly of developing countries who don't have, you know, anywhere to put these things. There's only so many items that a Salvation Army or a Goodwill, you know, might take when we're done with that piece. And then with the fast fashion aspect, we're not even seeing these clothes be viable long term, right? Because of the cheapness of the materials. So on the front end, it is, you know, the kind of crude oil that it takes to produce polyester, you know, or rayon or some of these, like, you know, cheaper synthetic fabrics. On that end, we're using crude oil to produce these non-natural fibers. And then, you know, discarding them, they do not biodegrade. They leak into our systems. And it's a tremendous issue, right?
Yeah.
And yes, I'm a fashion girly to my core. I actually went to FIT undergrad and studied international trade for the fashion industry. And in one of my last semesters, we talked a lot about like global textile production. And this was an issue when I was graduating in 2010, right? And you saw the kind of major fast fashion retailers talk about, you know, recycling or using more like sustainable cotton and things like that. I think right now the world is waking up to the fact that overconsumption is real, right?
Right.
And which is a challenge when you like new stuff. There's amazing new designers, and you know, you self-express through fashion, right? I had to go and start doing Rent the Runway when I was doing a lot of speaking engagements, number one, for cost efficiencies, but then also it was like, all right, do I need to keep buying, you know, more and more pieces every single month, right?
Yes.
How am I contributing to this problem? And I had to say to myself, honestly, earlier at the top of the year, and even just kind of last year, it was like, if I'm going to purchase something, I need to have some values around it. Right.
So right.
It is silk, linen, cotton, wool, cashmere, high quality fabrics that I know are going to last, things that I can keep in my closet that are going to be staple pieces that if all the stores close today, I know that I have a closet that's going to be timeless. Right. Yeah. And so really I tried to start pushing people towards number one, where we want to be grown up. We're talking about, you know, quiet wealth. We're talking about soft life, all these kinds of things. And how do we dress ourselves in natural fabrics? And then also understanding that the more we have so much plastic in our bodies, so much plastic in our environments. So imagining if we're doing big hauls from cheaper, less regulated, less kind of ethical, less principled places that all they're doing is volume. Imagine it's not just wreaking havoc on the environment, but you're having issues with lead, you're having issues with BPA, you're having issues with all of these things that we're putting on our body that look good, you know, from a distance, but then up close, it's like you have absolutely no idea how this is going to affect you, you know, down the line. And like I said, I think that people are waking up to my closet is full enough, or, hey, if I'm going to get these pieces, I'm going to invest in them. And then now I want to think about how do I want to discard these pieces when I'm done with them, right? Is that, am I giving them away? If they're high quality pieces, they can stay in the ecosystem, you know, for a while. But one of my mantras, quite honestly, is I have enough, I am enough, right? And I'm on this like kind of world tour right now. I only have 3 suitcases, so I cannot be out in the world buying too many things because my suitcase can only hold so much, right? And so I'm so glad that you asked this question because we really have to think about a different cycle of how we dress ourselves, right? And there's nothing wrong with dabbling and enjoying fashion and celebrating these amazing designers and brands, right? But imagine if more designers, and there's so many out there that are thinking much more sustainably. And imagine if we had a, what they call a cradle to cradle approach where, hey, I'm done with this garment. Maybe it's passed on to someone else and now they're fine. It's gone to Poshmark or something. You know, now at the end of its life cycle, maybe we can return it to a brand, or there's some amazing green tech companies that are now starting to take old textiles, break them down, and create whole new spools of fabric so that you can turn that into something else, right?
Absolutely.
So the innovation opportunity is there, but we also have to think about the fact that, like, let's stop buying fast fashion, right? Which is probably not going to happen, but also let's think about how we can thoughtfully consume.
Absolutely. And I'm happy that you have enlightened us and me, right? Because I told you from following your work, it has now inspired me to start thinking about the purchases that I make and how it affects our environment in this world. But like you said, I have enough. I am enough. I'm going to have to start internalizing that myself because, you know, I'm a fashion girly myself. So
I love fashion. I do. I'm a big fan. I'm like, oh, she put that together so cute. I love this. Absolutely.
I appreciate it. Well, thank you for joining us. But before we jump, just to kind of learn a little bit more about what's going on in Miami, I want to end with a little this or that with you, the tech version. So you just got to give me the first thing that comes to mind. Okay. Don't think too long. They're not that hard, I promise.
Okay, I'm going to say, whoo, okay.
Not too long. Okay, so build fast or build sustainably?
Build sustainably every time.
Always. Venture capital or bootstrapping?
Ooh, that's a tough one because it depends. But I will say bootstrap as long as you can and then go get the venture.
Okay. Silicon Valley or Miami?
Miami.
Good answer. Disruptive innovation or steady improvement?
Disruptive. Switch it up.
Tech utopia or tech caution?
Tech caution.
Okay. Honestly, I kind of low-key guessed the answers in my mind, and you proved me right. So I'm happy to hear that you answered the way you did.
I mean, you know me. I love it.
Good. So look, Shira, this was such a good time. I thank you for taking out the time to talk to us today. And I know you are enjoying your life right now and exploring the world. So thank you for just pausing to be a part of our world. And
yes,
so
thank you so much.
Of course. And so we'll talk soon. And thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Shirelle gave us a powerful lens on how innovation shapes culture and sustainability. But what does that actually look like here in the 305? When the rubber meets the road, when policy, law, and growth collide. To unpack that, I'm bringing in my partner, Mitch Bierman, who knows Miami-Dade inside and out from the legal and the municipal side. So Mitch, thank you so much for taking out the time to sit and unpack with us so we can really get into tech in Miami, right? So sure. Innovation is something that we constantly hear, tech as well, right? But we're now challenging ourselves to see like whether this is real or hype. When it comes down to Miami, what do you see it as? Is it real substance or is it just the hype that innovation is something that we're doing right now?
You know, I was born and raised in Miami, and I learned to recognize hype.
Yes.
And there is a lot of hype. There always is. It's Miami. That's right. What we sell. And yet, you know, that behind that shimmer and shine, there's always some substance. And so we do have a tech industry that's coming here. It does appear that we have capital that's coming in behind it. And we have a lot of great individual founders
right.
that want to be here. And talents come in from around the world. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there is some substance behind it. What's attracting them may be some of the hype. But if it's working,
then you know, so be it.
Right.
I don't mind it either. So, but when it comes down to really becoming a tech hub, if a city wants to be that, what does it require from the legal standpoint to, how can we help clients, I guess, become that tech hub?
I think before we get to legal, we need to get to education, honestly. The reason that Silicon Valley was a tech hub is because it had Stanford and Berkeley. And the reason that New York works is it has Princeton and Columbia, and Boston has MIT and Harvard. And we have much younger schools.
Very true.
And they will come along. But they're still not specializing in teaching those things. So, you know, and maybe it's not going to be that for us. Maybe something else is going to be the attractor. But I always saw that as I was watching tech develop as an industry, it developed around those institutions.
Right.
And so our institutions need to meet the moment. And then I think we really fly. As lawyers, we are, and especially in our firm, you know, we're very involved in the community. We're very involved in building this community. And all of us who've been involved in chamber of commerce type activities and Beacon Council have stressed that education piece. And I think our institutions have responded or have attempted to respond, but that takes some time. The second thing is having the talent in the law firms to support the deals so that they're not all done in New York and Boston, that we can do the deals here. And that's happening too. The firms that did the deals in New York and Boston see that people are coming here and they're here for that. And they hire and train the talent as well that can handle those deals. The third piece, or the second piece, but it fills in between education and law, is the capital.
Right.
And we need, you know, I heard of somebody from SoftBank a number of years ago who was on a panel with me, and he said, every deal comes to Silicon Valley. I want to find the alphas that don't come there. I'm going to the Caribbean. I'm going to Mexico. I'm going to Florida because that's, you know, where a lot of those ideas are happening. And so I think that that was a really interesting observation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that you broke it down so easily for people to understand that it's before we get to, you know, C, we got to go through A and B, right? And so you brought up such a good point as it relates to education. Just shifting gears slightly, what we spoke about earlier with Sherelle, we spoke about a lot about sustainability, right? And how does these two worlds connect and still be able to achieve both, right? Both innovation, but also be sustainable. We deal with sustainability issues a lot in South Florida. So just your take on sustainability and how do you see us advancing in that area in the future?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think here it's life and death. And so you've got people who are from here. And I can give you a perfect example. The living seawalls, right? The living seawalls was invented by a lawyer who came here from Russia. She still has a Russian accent. She probably came as a child, but she went to UM Law School. And she came up with this idea of doing, 3D printing living seawalls. Well, it's extremely sustainable. It doesn't poison the water the way concrete does. I mean, you need seawalls no matter what, but we always thought we needed concrete. And she found something that worked better. And now all the local government and her lawyers and government affairs consultants have pushed this, but all the local governments see the benefit of that.
Yep.
And they're doing it. And that's a Miami-based founder that came up. The company's called Kind Designs. And I've, through a venture fund that I invest in, we invested in her. I wish I could invest more because it's going to, I think, just change that the whole picture for seawalls and for us to protect our land from water incursion and also to do it in a way that's more sustainable. So
absolutely
very exciting sustainability innovation that came out of the needs that are created by the situation that we are in this geography.
Yeah, which I think what makes you Miami so unique is just that, is that we are positioned where there's opportunity for growth. There's opportunity for us to be seen as the innovators, but there's also opportunities that's only given to us, right? Who else do you really know that deal with the type of environmental issues that we deal with? Right. So it does take big, bright brains to analyze these issues. What's something that you wish more people were aware of, whether in the space of tech, innovation, sustainability, that, you know, more people can get behind and push?
I've got the perfect answer to that.
Tell me, I want to know.
I wish more people were aware of how receptive our local governments are to these innovations. Because the example I just gave, they drank that up like it was...
Including the municipality, which I, you know, serve as lead counsel for. We're actually doing a living seawall ourselves. So.
They didn't need a lobbyist to at all. The founder could go herself and say, this is what I'm doing. They did have some help, and I helped getting the approval at the county level. But once it was approved at the county level, the cities all jumped all over it. And so, you know, as government affairs lawyers, we are seeing our governments really eagerly want to participate. Right. Want to participate in the growth of tech, certainly want to participate in anything that's sustainable. And it's really nonpartisan because when it comes to having a sustainable environment in South Florida, everyone, regardless of their affiliations, wants that, needs that. They know that's their job.
Right. Absolutely. So thank you so much, Mitch, because I think you provide such an interesting take, because you know Miami-Dade, you know Miami through and through. And when it comes down to even connections at the county level, at the local levels, at the state levels, you are such a powerful player in that realm to be able to get the approvals that need to be got, that these companies need to innovate and sustain and do all the things that they want to do. So I'm really happy that you took out the time to be with us and just to share a little bit about what we're doing.
So thank you. Thank you,
Shanae. In one word though, I want you to say what do you believe is the future for Miami when it comes down to innovation, tech, and sustainability? In one word, can you sum it up?
One word?
Yeah, or two. I'll give you two.
The future is unlimited.
All right. I like it. I like it. All right. Thanks again, Mitch. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Shane.
That's a wrap for today's episode of The Intersection. We explored how vision, innovation, and policy intersect to shape Miami's future. Big thanks to Sherelle Dorsey and Mitch Bierman for lending their voices and insights. And thank you for tuning in, because this conversation isn't just about tech or law. It's about the future we're all building together. Until next time, keep asking bold questions, and we'll be back at another intersection.